This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. As of today, and this could change, there are 8 current or former governors seeking their party's nominations for president. While Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy is not one of them, he is certainly not shy about discussing those who are. Malloy, who was elected chair of the 2016 Democratic Governors Association, has gone after his Republican counterparts in New Jersey, Wisconsin, and Louisiana in magazine interviews and on cable news shows. But like those he likes to spar with, Malloy has faced some of his own challenges in running his state. So today, Where We Live, how's Connecticut doing when stacked up against some states run by high-profile Republicans? Chris Christie in New Jersey, Scott Walker in Wisconsin, Bobby Jindal in Louisiana. We'll talk with reporters in each of those states and with you. You can join us at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. But joining us first is Keith Faniff. He's the state budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. We call him our state budget guru. And Keith, it's great to have you back on the show. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, let's just get up to speed on Dan Malloy's performance in office so far. We've talked about a lot of things over the years about his ability to close a budget gap that he inherited after the Jody Rell administration, some of the moves he's made around taxes. I guess I'm wondering, first of all, if you can just give an overview of everything Dan Malloy said he was going to do. How's Dan Malloy doing right now?
Governor Malloy, if you're grading on the curve, is doing okay. The challenge is, of course, this is a governor who likes to make very bold, sweeping pronouncements. That's sort of in keeping with the theme of this show. And when you grade them against that, that's when he starts to run into some problems. Just to remind people, we're talking about a governor who didn't just inherit a huge, almost a 20% hole in the state's operating budget. This is a governor who took office in 2011 as Connecticut, because it lags the nation, was just really beginning to crawl out of the Great Recession. And unfortunately, and even, Governor Malloy and most governors didn't anticipate this, it would crawl out of the recession into this very sluggish, prolonged, dragging on and on recovery that's just moving in baby steps. And that's really been the problem for him. He came in with goals of stabilizing state finances, of getting Connecticut to start to take on its responsibilities in the areas of its long-term obligations and pensions. He said, of course, he was going to do this without forcing shredding the safety net or trying to spare education or municipal aid from having to sacrifice. And this is where he has had to make some compromises, because the economic bounce back never arrived like he was looking for. And he's kind of caught between the hammer and the anvil. These pensions and obligations that he took on are very, very heavy. And the economic engine he's working with is nowhere near as powerful as he thought it was going to be.
And of course, because of the sluggish recovery, in part, Malloy has said, look, I also don't want to raise taxes on the hardworking people of Connecticut. Like many Republican governors and also many Democratic governors around the country, he says, look, if we raise taxes on the highest income earners too much, it's going to tamp down the growth even more. Something that you've reported on a lot is he said that he's not going to raise taxes, but we do indeed have higher taxes now than we did before.
You raised two issues there as far as who you raise taxes on. This is one place where Governor Malloy has definitely drifts away from a huge segment of at least the Connecticut Democratic Party. I mean, this is a governor who's used lines like, I don't want to punish success. Some Democrats have seen that as almost Reagan-esque. This is in reference to not wanting to go high in the top marginal rate on the income tax. Some Democrats see that as coddling the hedge funds. They have no problem going, putting Connecticut with a rate comparable to what New York and New Jersey has for a top marginal rate. We do not have that right now. But as far as this last budget, Governor Malloy, he did absolutely propose tax increases. He tried to use some very tortured definitions that of what a tax increase is that were so narrow they'd even contradicted his previous term's definitions. We have a new budget that he signed that raises taxes about $650 million a year and reneges on another $250 million in tax cuts that weren't just promised. These were adopted in the last term, signed by the governor in the last term, and scheduled to start in the new one, and then at the last minute were taken away. On the plus side, there are on paper, and I want to emphasize that on paper, big new investments in transportation and municipal aid. The asterisk on that is that really the big money doesn't start until 2017. And unfortunately, at the same time, there's another built-in deficit that's about three times the size of the investment in transportation and three times the size of the investment in municipal aid. People already expecting these are going to get cut back. The governor wanted a lockbox for transportation, and the legislature doesn't want to give it to him.
Of course, as we talk throughout this hour about these four governors here, Dan Malloy and some of his rivals on the GOP side, we'll take your calls at 860-275-7266. One of the stated reasons why Malloy has decided to invest in transportation, but also tried to hold off on tax increases because of competition from nearby states, something that he talks about an awful lot. One of those nearby states is New Jersey, and the Republican Governor Chris Christie, who, of course, himself is a very high-profile, not just governor, but now presidential candidate. Here's Malloy back in February on MSNBC talking about the New Jersey governor's efforts to defund that state's pension program.
Well, I want to go back to this Christie question. This is a guy who has purposefully defunded the pension system. He wants to destroy it. He's taken orders from the Kochs and others. He wants to destroy that system. If he can do it, he's going to do it. Christie will rise or fall by what he's done. I think what he's done to the New Jersey in seven downgrades, more to come, by the way, and in defunding the pension is going to catch up with him. I think he's a non-factor in this election cycle.
Dan Malloy loves to talk about Chris Christie. Here's someone who covers Chris Christie all the time. It's Matt Arco. He's a State House reporter for the New Jersey Advance Media. He writes for NJ.com and the Star Ledger. Matt, welcome to our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
Also with us on the line is Heather Long, who joins us from New York. She's the markets and investing editor for CNN Money. Hi there, Heather.
Good morning.
Hey, Matt, I'll ask you first, just before we get to some of the pension issues with Chris Christie, I asked Keith Faniff off the top, you know, sort of how Dan Malloy is doing as governor. Largely, how's Chris Christie been doing in keeping some of his promises and running the ship of state in New Jersey?
Well, you know, where things stand right now are kind of interesting. You know, right now I'm in New Hampshire. I'm covering the governor on the presidential campaign trail. Back in New Jersey, you know, as far as his polling goes, the governor has kind of sunk to historic lows. So I think, you know, New Jersey as a whole is a little upset, it seems, or the majority of folks are upset that the governor's running for president. I think they feel that, according to the polling, that he sort of turned his back on New Jersey. Whether or not other Republicans running for president or Republican governors like Scott Walker are dealing with the same thing, Christie has argued that folks like Scott Walker are. But, you know, we certainly, back in New Jersey, have issues. I just heard a reporter talk about your folks' budget issues, and we're still dealing with a lot of those same things, especially in the world of pensions, which is the hot-button issue now. So I think folks feel as though the governor is sort of he's trying to woo a new crowd now and sort of turn their backs for the most part.
So get us up to speed on this pension situation with Governor Christie. The New Jersey Supreme Court has ruled that the administration isn't on the hook for about $1.5 billion in pension payments that a lower court previously said were owed. This has been a long-running dispute. This Supreme Court decision seen as a victory for Chris Christie, but is it just a short-term victory, Matt?
No, it's absolutely a short-term victory, because what the Supreme Court decision essentially did was say, okay, the governor's administration doesn't have to fund pensions at the levels that you know, he essentially promised to when he first took office. He signed a budget law or a pension and health benefit reform law during his first term. You know, so the administration was on the hook for about, you know, $1.3 billion pension payment. The governor Christie argued just before our last budget that the state does not have the money for it. Which, you know, we're talking about the Great Recession. New Jersey has had a hard time coming back. We haven't come back as strongly as some of our neighbors. You know, so the money really isn't there. So Christie's right in that. Governor Malloy, I heard the comment there that, you know, Governor Christie's purposely defunding the pensions. You know, I don't know if that's exactly accurate. I think it's more accurate to say that the state of New Jersey doesn't have the money. So what the governor essentially did was take it to court so that he wouldn't have this massive budget hole right before, you know, he's mounting his presidential campaign. And the court sided with the administration, but certainly, you know, said that there's some serious issues. And it's something that the state is going to have to continue to contend with. I'll just say that Governor Christie now suggests that the legislature should adopt new pension and health care reforms to kind of curb the rising cost of these pensions. But the state worker unions have said that they're not willing to negotiate with the governor at this time.
Before I get to Heather, I just want Keith to jump in. One of the things that Matt said that I think is so important to this conversation, we could probably have this in any state in the country, which is maybe the state just doesn't have the money to pay the pension obligations that it has. And almost every state is kind of in that boat. Is this a matter, Keith, of rhetoric around pension payments? Or is this a reality that indeed, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, state after state after state is probably going to have to take a really serious look at what the long-term obligations are and how you're going
to
deal with it?
This is a little of column A and a little of column B. And I'll just point to Governor Malloy's track record. He came in 2012 and said, okay, I've got my budget stabilized in the first year. Now I'm going to come back and I'm going to deal with the state employees' pension system. Or we're going to actually open up the contract and commit to pay more. The problem was Governor Malloy's plan to pay for that extra expense was the economy will get better and it will cover the extra cost, just the money that's coming in. It didn't come in. So then what has he done since then? We've borrowed money for things that we were supposed to pay cash. We took a holiday on debt payments. We've taken hundreds of millions of dollars of bond premiums. And if you translate that, what he's really done is use one credit card to pay off another credit card. And that's the part that it's kind of hard for him to say, look at the commitment we're making to paying down our pension debt by running up our bonded debt. I think that's the area where I think he started with a very sincere goal, but it was all founded on this hope the recovery was going to get better. And that's been Governor Malloy's Achilles heel again and again.
Heather, I want to go to you because one of the things that Chris Christie really wanted to do as he kicked off this presidential campaign, which we all knew was eventually coming, is make pension reform one of his top priorities. And now with this case in the Supreme Court and some of the problems that he's faced, can he actually make this claim?
Yeah, I'd just like to make a little bit of a fact check on what you just said. While states across the country certainly have pension problems, there is a big differentiation between how poorly some states are doing versus others.
Fair enough.
Even if we just compare Connecticut and New Jersey has a much, much lower credit rating from the Moody's and the S&P credit rating agencies in the world because of its pension problems. I won't get into all the details, but your listeners may be familiar with minor league baseball leagues, you know, the single A, the double A, the triple A. Well, Connecticut still ranks in the AAA leagues pretty good, even though it's in the lower ranks of that AAA league. You know, New Jersey's just hanging on in single A. So, you know, New Jersey and Illinois have by far and away, other than Puerto Rico, the worst debt ratings in the country right now because of their unfunded pension obligations. So while there are a lot of similarities between the two states, certainly Wall Street has spoken in terms of thinking that New Jersey is in a much worse situation right now. Mm.
I totally agree, but I guess I would point out, sticking with your analogy, Connecticut's ability to hit breaking pitches and other things are being exposed in the minors. At this point, our bond ratings, not you're absolutely right, not as bad as New Jersey's. We've kind of slipped back to the middle of the pack, and as far as our unfunded pension and retirement obligation liabilities go, and this is a problem that goes back decades before Governor Malloy, we are right up there with Illinois as like one of the worst two states in the country. The only thing that's salvaging Connecticut from having a much worse credit rating is its tremendous wealth all in Fairfield County.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And of course, there's tremendous wealth in parts of New Jersey as well. So what does all this mean for Governor Christie, Heather, the politician, someone who is trying to raise his national profile around issues like this? Because it can be a Republican talking point that I'm going to take on, as Scott Walker does, private sector unions, or as Chris Christie does, public sector unions, and also the public sector workers who have very large pension obligations coming. Is this a winning strategy for Chris Christie, whether it's as a presidential candidate or long term in New Jersey?
Well, it certainly got him a lot of attention on the national stage because he attacked this issue early on in his governorship. But I think the biggest problem for Christie now, there's sort of two problems. Number one is Donald Trump, because Christie wanted to position himself as the straight talk guy. You know, I'm telling it like it is. And Donald Trump certainly has stolen that kind of spotlight, for better or worse, right now. I think the other big problem for Christie is that Republicans, okay, he's come in, he's made some reforms that seem like they're out of the traditional GOP playbook, but the problem is the New Jersey economy is not doing very well. So his track record since making those reforms is simply not that good. You know, last year in 2014, New Jersey had one of the worst economies in the country. You know, the GDP was barely positive. It was basically flat. You know, and he's running against people like a Texas governor, which has one of the best state economies, growing over 5%, better than the nation as a whole, or Florida economy, growing around close to 3%. So unemployment in New Jersey is higher than the national average. It's still at 6%, whereas most of his competitor states, like the Wisconsins and certainly the Texas and Floridas of the world, are much lower than the national average, or about par. So I think when people are looking at New Jersey and saying, okay, Christie's made all these reforms, but what does he have to show for it? There were only three states in the country in the last few years that have seen increases in poverty in their state, according to the Census Bureau. One of those three is New Jersey. So you kind of look across. It's not just like they have one problem. You look across the board at New Jersey, and the economy just isn't doing that well.
So, Matt, what do people who you talk to on a daily basis say about that? Are they holding this at the feet of the governor, or does this have to do with the government as a whole? Does this have to do with just slow recovery from a really bad recession in a fairly complex, bifurcated state like New Jersey? I mean, who are people blaming for this, Matt?
Look, I mean, the issue at hand is over years now, we were talking about slow recovery. I heard Keith talk earlier about kind of Governor Beloy wanted to, invest more in the pensions on rosy projections, which is exactly kind of the hole that Governor Christie found himself into following the Great Recession. So, but as far as who folks are blaming, look, the hot button issue in New Jersey right now is funding the pensions. The governor is arguing that we need more cuts and that the money isn't there, and the unions want the governor to fund the pension fully, and it's just not going to happen right now just because, the state cannot unless it raises a ton of taxes. I mean, you're talking about billions of dollars. So, that works into the whole kind of dissatisfaction with the governor at the moment. I'll just say real quick, though, about whether or not other Republicans will kind of use this to attack Christie. We haven't seen that yet. On the campaign trail, but you have to remember that Governor Christie right now, he's kind of toward the end of the pack. He's perilously, we'll find out tomorrow whether or not he's going to be on the main stage Thursday for the first Republican debate. But I think if he does become, say, more of a threat to these other, GOP frontrunners, you're 100% going to see them kind of attacking the governor on that because, it's one of his serious claims of his first term that he came in as a Republican governor and got this pension and health care benefit overhaul. He immediately after it was enacted, he kind of toured the national stage, and that was one of the big things that got him in the national conversation. And you don't really see him boasting about it as much anymore. He can't. When pressed on it, because it's still a New Jersey issue, he points to Democrats not wanting to concede anything else at this point as to kind of say that, okay, they're the issue now that's driving the state into this hole. Which, okay, you can argue that one way or the other, but it still doesn't take into account that, he said that back in 2010, his reforms then were supposed to fix the problem, and it's really kind of just scratched the surface.
Last thing for you, Heather, we're going to be talking about a group of governors here who may have had some issues in the way they're running their very complex states, but Chris Christie is the only one that has a secondary scandal kind of looming over him. It's the aftermath of the Bridgegate scandal, where members of his administration were tied to a shutdown on the George Washington Bridge. Do you think that as he heads into this presidential run, that this, Heather, is still lingering over Chris Christie, that people still remember that day the bridge was shut down?
I think it definitely is. He actually talked about this on CNN yesterday. He was on Jake Tapper's show, and he was flat out asked about it. And he's very combative, and he came right back and tried to say, look, there's been three independent investigations, and all three say that there's no link. But as Jake Tapper fired back, yes, but various prosecutors have also said they're open to more information. And so there's sort of a hint that there's kind of an ongoing look at this going on. And I think, just the New Jersey approval ratings overall speak for themselves. After Hurricane Sandy in that November 2012 period when Christie was on the upsurge, he had a 77% approval rating in his state. The latest readings are down at 30% from his own state. So, again, just looking in his own area, let alone across the country, he's not resonating in the same way he used to be.
Heather Long is the markets and investing editor for CNN Money. Heather, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Matt Arco, State House reporter for New Jersey Advance Media. Thank you, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
When we come back, we're going to be talking about another governor who Governor Malloy has been sparring with, Scott Walker of Wisconsin. We're joined today by Keith Faniff. He's our budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror. We're going to be talking to him more about the performance in office of Dan Malloy and some of these Republicans who he's been taking on. You can join us at 860-275-7266. We'll be right back after this break. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today on the program, a look at the track record of four governors, all of whom are in the national spotlight. Our own Governor Dan Malloy, as he takes the helm of the Democratic Governors Association, and three Republicans running for president. Up next, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. At CPAC this year, Walker rallied the base with war stories of his victory over organized labor. Let's hear some of that along with Malloy's response.
We returned the power back into the hands of the hardworking taxpayers. They didn't like that. They tried to recall me. They made me their number one target. But in the end, we showed that we can fight and win for the hardworking taxpayers. Because of that, in our state, we don't have seniority or tenure anymore. We can hire and fire based on merit. We can put the best and the brightest in our classrooms, and we can keep them there.
You know, he talks about being able to fire and hire at will. You know, we have a progressive movement in the United States that's over 100 years old. Nobody believes that good, hardworking teachers should be able to be thrown out of a classroom. They're rolling back things that are really vitally important to how our democracy works.
That's Dan Malloy talking on MSNBC, responding to Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. Before we bring in an expert from Wisconsin to talk about how that governor's done there, we're going to bring back in Keith Faniff, who's the budget reporter for the Connecticut Mirror, our budget guru. Talk a little bit, if you would, Keith, about Governor Malloy's relationship with the public sector unions.
It's been up and down. I think he kept most of his promises in this area. I mean, he talked about in his first term working with state employees. He did. There were some people who say he didn't get enough concessions. He certainly didn't get as many as he originally claimed he had gotten. However, he did do better than any of his predecessors in terms of getting sacrifices. His road with the Connecticut's public school teachers has certainly been rocky from the time he proposed reforming tenure and made a comment he would later apologize for, saying all you have to do is show up to get tenure. However, the situation is still sort of up in the air because the unions are paying very close attention to the new state budget that took effect about a month ago. That two-year plan, according to analysts, is really not sustainable. And as soon as it's over, starting July 1, 2017, there's a built-in hole of almost $1 billion, and it's a deficit that there's significant potential for it to grow larger because it's based on some rosy economic assumptions.
We're talking today about Governor Malloy, his relationship with three other governors, all of whom who are running for the presidential nomination this year. Ruth Conniff joins us. She's a Yale graduate, now editor of the Progressive magazine in Madison, Wisconsin. Ruth, welcome to the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, great to be here.
So it's been a few years since the protests, the attempted recall of Scott Walker over his fight against organized labor. Has the dust settled in Wisconsin?
No, I would not say the dust has settled at all. You know, Walker is really the most divisive governor in the history of the state, and he continues to run now for president on this program of being tough and being willing to take it to unions and teachers. And you know, he's really, I think, as a presidential candidate, like Christie in some ways, running on his reputation as somebody who is extremely principled in his view, but, you know, extremely divisive. I mean, his approval rating in the state of Wisconsin is 41%. So it's interesting, even as his star rises with the Republican base as a presidential candidate, it's not at all clear that he could win the state of Wisconsin in a presidential year.
It's not clear that he could win the state of Wisconsin. And why is that? I mean, where's the backlash coming from exactly, Ruth?
Well, you know, Wisconsin prior to Walker was a pretty congenial bipartisan political environment. We had years and years and years of Governor Tommy Thompson, who got along famously with Democrats and union members, and who was proud of things like expanding access to health care for low-income children. Walker, on the other hand, has governed as really a very unapologetic right-winger. He brags about closing down Planned Parenthood clinics all over the state. He's imposed the largest cuts to what had been a top-tier K-12 public education system in the history of the state, almost $1 billion in cuts, which are sustained in his current budget. He cut $250 million out of the University of Wisconsin, which was shocking to Badger fans. Rolled back tenure, not just the teacher tenure you're talking about in the public schools, but university professors' tenure. We have, in our great research university, many professors packing their bags and leaving with their grant money because of those cuts to the university. And he's been very, very aggressive in his budget cutting, and he's been mired in some scandals, tax giveaways to some of his campaign contributors that have not boosted the economy as he claimed that they would when he created this quasi-private development agency, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. Instead, there have been a series of news articles about giveaways to companies with no tracking of whether they created jobs, some of those companies then outsourcing jobs. And the net result is that our economy is lagging the region and the nation. So, you know, a lot of people in Wisconsin are not happy, but he fires up the base. He fires up the right-wing base, especially in the suburbs of Milwaukee. Things like drug testing welfare recipients are big applause lines for him and his announcement for president. So there's a, you know, there's a very aggressive style of politics that's actually very new to the state of Wisconsin.
Keith Faniff, I want to get into a couple of those issues, and Ruth will talk more about this in just a moment. Governor Malloy here in Connecticut, in terms of funding for K through 12 education and then funding for the state university system, there's two parts to this, of course. First, of course, K through 12 education. There's so much emphasis placed on the property tax here in Connecticut. There's so much funding that comes directly from towns and cities, but yet the state government plays a big role there. On the higher education side, there's been a huge sea change in the way the state education system has worked under Governor Malloy. UConn sort of being set off to the side with the CSU system and all of the community colleges being grouped together. Maybe you can take these one by one. How's he done as far as providing K through 12 education?
K through 12 might be the area where he most separates himself from all of these other governors that he's been sparring with. On paper, you might say, well, Governor Malloy had a modest increase in education grants to cities and towns during his first term. And the word modest is really unfair because one of the things that he inherited was an education cost sharing system that was propped up with temporary federal money that Governor Rell had left, and it all expired when Governor Malloy took over. So over his first 4 years, he had to backfill the equivalent of a combined four-year billion-dollar hole. That might have been the single biggest public school teacher job saving program in modern state history. And it was all done in a very low-key fashion. A lot of people didn't realize it. The governor didn't even tout it as much as some other Democrats said he should have on the campaign trail. When it comes to higher education, you're right. There's been a real cost shift there. There have been some efforts to reorganize our state university system and our community colleges. But what's really stuck out is that college students definitely were asked to pick up a share, a significant share of the state budget deficit that Governor Malloy inherited. Since he's taken office, tuition and fees at the University of Connecticut are up in double digits in the state university and the community college system. The same thing, we're talking in the realm of about 15%, and more are anticipated as we continue to, at best, give flat aid to UConn and the state universities. In that area, people can definitely point to higher education and say the cost is going up. Yes, the governor has talked about making investments in things like Next Generation, a program at UConn to add more engineering. Most of his investments to date, though, have come on the credit card, and we've had a huge ballooning in that. And that's it's easier to do because the bill comes due later.
As you talk, Ruth Conniff, about Scott Walker's funding of the higher education system in Wisconsin, maybe it would be instructive for our listeners to just talk a little bit about what that system is and what it was meant to be. Wisconsin has this very intricate network of state schools, something that's very different from a lot of states here in the East. Maybe describe what the UW system is first and then what Scott Walker's done to it.
Well, so So it was interesting to hear the quote that you played from Governor Malloy talking about the 100-year-old progressive tradition in this country. And the Progressive magazine was founded over 100 years ago by Fighting Bob LaFalla, who launched the Progressive Party, was a big part of the progressive movement. And that is really a strong political current in Wisconsin. So in setting up the University of Wisconsin system, there's something called the Wisconsin Idea, which is that the system, the University of Wisconsin system, the flagship university in Madison, big UW campus in Madison, center of research, is sort of the heart of it. And then all around the state, there are extension schools that are meant to serve the people of Wisconsin. And there's an idea of a symbiotic relationship between the citizens of the state and the university, that the university should bring, you know, historically has brought a lot of agricultural know-how to far-flung parts of the state, has brought people even in rural areas into high-quality local campuses, and has sort of nurtured the economy, fed the intellectual life of the state. And one of the most controversial things that Scott Walker has done is in his state budget, he had struck the heart of the mission statement of the University of Wisconsin, although it's not a budgetary item. So, in fact, the words, the search for truth, were deleted from the UW's mission in the budget. And that caused an enormous stir among, you know, not just Wisconsinites, but alumni of the university who really have a deep sense of pride and devotion to this idea of a, you know, a truly public institution that serves the people and that the people have a stake in Wisconsin.
Getting to the K-12 system, are there some of the same fights over funding for charter schools in Wisconsin that we see here in Connecticut?
Yeah, so this is another arm. So there's sort of a dual assault on public education in Wisconsin, which has been really dramatic to watch. Wisconsin, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, was the birthplace of school vouchers, the idea that poor kids ought to be able to get a cash voucher equal to the amount of money the state or the locality sends to spend them to send them to school and take that voucher and go to a private school. And this was a 25 years ago an experimental program in Milwaukee, and it had a lot of bipartisan appeal, the idea being that, you know, poor kids should be able to get out of their local public school if it's not good and go to private school. The problem with that program over time has been that test results show no improvement for these kids, and there's a whole tier of fly-by-night storefront schools that have popped up to take advantage of these school vouchers, some really dramatically low-end schools. There's a place called the Life Skills Academy in a rundown storefront where the proprietors took a bunch of voucher money from kids and then fled to Florida. And I've seen a bunch of these schools in former gas stations and crumbling office buildings. No real curriculum requirement, no teacher training requirement aside from the idea that teachers need to be working towards a BA in some subject area. A lot of peculiar curriculum that you can see. The Bob Jones curriculum is one curriculum I watched being taught, a group of middle schoolers learning creationism in science class. So this program, controversial as it is, has been expanded statewide under Walker in Wisconsin, and a lot of localities outside of Milwaukee do not want school vouchers. It takes money right off the top of education funds, and it turns out in the voucher expansion that Walker has imposed, 70% of families who are receiving the vouchers had never sent their kids to public school at all. So it's a straight-up subsidy for private school tuition. And it comes in conjunction with these dramatic historic cuts to public education funding.
So
Walker's also proposed a statewide charter school district. So this is the, you know, charter operators coming in to run a separate system of schools. And what one legislator described, a Republican legislator described this as, is a completely second system of education, K-12 education in Wisconsin. So we have less money, and yet we're trying to fund two different education systems at the same time.
So nothing like that here in Connecticut as far as the voucher program, but as Ruth is talking about, certainly an effort to fund more charter schools in the state. Probably, Keith, nothing as extensive in Connecticut either now or in the near future as what's being proposed in Wisconsin, but it certainly did cause some political ripples throughout this last legislative session, the ability to fund more charter schools here in the state.
Yes, you raised two very important points. One, nobody, as far as in our charter school debate, has talked about some of the horrible situations like we just heard about. Nobody's questioning the overall quality of the charter schools. There's nothing in a gas station. I want to make that clear. Nothing like that. However, what people are saying is that the critics will say that the charter school system differs from traditional public schools in that it is something that's elite. They are cherry picking the best students in the poorer areas, draining state resources, and then leaving all the other students whose grades aren't good enough to get into the charter schools to be in urban primarily urban districts that are even more depleted of money. That's been the real problem, and it does not, you know, doesn't help in the fact that the administration definitely took scarce resources this year and put them in charter schools, including schools that have ties to some of the governor's biggest campaign donors.
Ruth, just the last thing for you, and just have a minute or so left. We already talked about a governor in Chris Christie who is not polling terribly well right now in his run for president, and he's maybe been out-Christied by Donald Trump. On the other end, we're going to be talking about Bobby Jindal, someone in Louisiana whose campaign never really got off the ground. Meanwhile, Scott Walker, for all the things that you've said, he is polling in the top group of Republican candidates. He is someone who clearly... his message from Wisconsin resonates across America. What do people in Wisconsin think of the governor?
I mean, as I said, he's got 41% approval rate. He's an immensely divisive figure in Wisconsin, and he's pulling right behind Donald Trump for a reason, because he has a message that is a more palatable version of Donald Trump's message. Donald Trump is talking to the anti-immigrant racist base, and that's where he's getting a lot of traction. Scott Walker's politics also arise out of that. His biggest applause lines in his announcement were drug testing welfare recipients, voter ID, programs that specifically target minorities in the Milwaukee area. And that, the suburbs of Milwaukee, the white right-wing base, that is his base. There was a tremendous cover story in the New Republic about a year ago describing that racial politics that drives Walker. And I think that's really the undercovered aspect of his political career.
Ruth Conniff is editor of the Progressive Magazine in Madison, Wisconsin, talking about Governor Scott Walker. Thanks so much, Ruth. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, great to be with you.
When we come back, Bobby Jindal's campaign for president has exactly taken off. He'll not be on the stage likely for the prime time debate this week. We'll look at how he's been doing in running Louisiana as we continue with Keith Faniff of the Connecticut Mirror, and we talk about four governors here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, the Litchfield Jazz Festival celebrates its 20th anniversary this year, and we'll be broadcasting from the site of the festival's jazz camp, which exposes young musicians to some of the best instructors in the world of jazz. The festival is also celebrating the groundbreaking Connecticut composer and saxophonist Tom Chapin, and we'll hear from some of those who remember him. Hope you can join us for a musical conversation tomorrow on Where We Live. Today, a look at the track record of four governors, all of whom are in the national spotlight. Our own Governor Dan Malloy, as he takes the helm of the Democratic Governors Association in 2016, and three Republicans running for president next year. Up next, Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal. You might remember how Malloy and Jindal had a dust-up on the steps of the Capitol during what was supposed to be a bipartisan event. Here's Jindal first.
What I worry about is that the Obama economy is now the minimum wage economy. I think there are things we can do instead of waving the white flag of surrender, instead of declaring this economy to be a minimum wage economy. I think America can do better.
One second. Until a few moments ago, we were going down a pretty cooperative road. You just heard what I think ended up being probably the most partisan statement that we've had all weekend. So let's be very clear. There are many people like myself who support a minimum wage and an increase in a minimum wage. We have a plan to get to $10.10. I don't know what the heck was a reference to white flag when it comes to people making $404 a week. I mean, that's the most insane statement I've ever heard, quite frankly.
So notwithstanding the rhetoric between Dan Malloy and Bobby Jindal, we want to talk a little bit about how these two states are doing. We have Keith Faniff here from the Connecticut Mirror. He's the state budget guru of the Mirror. Also joining us now is Robert Mann. He's an author, journalist, and political historian. He writes a political column each week for NOLA.com and the Times-Picayune. Robert Mann, welcome to Where We Live.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
So we hear Jindal calling the Obama economy the minimum wage economy. Does Bobby Jindal try to raise the minimum wage there in Louisiana?
No, he's very much opposed to raising the minimum wage, and it's a bit ironic to hear Jindal critique anyone's economic record. He's presiding over a state that has, the last time I checked, the sixth highest unemployment rate in the nation. He's not really criticizing Obama from a position of strength on that.
So, of course, he oversees a state which has been through so much. I mean, this year we're marking the 10-year anniversary of the flood and Hurricane Katrina. How much of the problem that Louisiana has had in employing people, in raising the overall welfare of the people of that state, how much of it is at the feet of Bobby Jindal, and how much of it is at the feet of, well, a whole bunch of circumstances out of his control?
Well, you know, it's been 10 years, so I don't think that Jindal can blame Katrina. In fact, I think that Katrina, in many ways, in the long term, revitalized this economy. I mean, we had tens of billions of dollars in federal funds that were flowing into the state. And yeah, I think the story of New Orleans is quite remarkable in its resurgence and its economic rebound in so many ways. I mean, it's not that it doesn't have a lot of problems, and it does still. But I think what happened when Jindal came into office is that there was still a lot of that Katrina money flowing into the state coffers, and he and the people around him, I believe, mistook the resurgence of the economy, the money in the budget, for something more permanent than I think it was, and they drastically cut state income taxes to the tune of about an $800 million hole in that budget every year now because of those income tax reductions. And Jindal sort of started out with hobbled himself, and then the recession came along and made it even worse, and we never really recovered. I mean, I think they thought that they were going to just be in a temporary hole here, and the economy would come roaring back after the recession ended. And for Louisiana, the recession never really ended in that way. We've just finished a legislative session where the governor faced a $1.6 billion shortfall, and he leaves the next governor, who will take over in January, a $1 billion shortfall. So it has never been anything but financial disaster in the state since Jindal has been governor.
And Keith Vanoff, quickly, I mean, this is something we've tracked for a while here. We have a governor in Dan Malloy who has left a big budget deficit. He's closed some of that deficit, certainly, but as you say, the out years for Governor Malloy or whoever the next governor of the state of Connecticut is, that's a very real deficit looming here as well.
Absolutely. I think that's why I wonder if it isn't part of the Malloy strategy to stay every so often to put Governor Malloy next to people like Governor Jindal so that they can draw a sharper contrast. Because, yes, this is a governor in terms of Daniel Malloy who's preserved municipal aid and supported while he was running for reelection a municipal aid increase. But it's also a governor who, when he first took office, said it wasn't the time for a minimum wage increase. When he took office, said it wasn't the time for that, didn't want to punish success by having a big increase in the top income tax rate. This year blocked the capital gains rate from being reinstated and improved big corporate assistance. That would be perceived in Connecticut as almost on the conservative side of the Democratic Party. But again, if you put Governor Malloy next to Governor Jindal, things look different.
Of course, on the issue of education, Robert, you know, Connecticut and Louisiana are very, very different places. Connecticut, maybe we've seen a little bit higher costs for students going to state colleges. Maybe we've seen some flat funding of some things where advocates want a little bit more funding. But essentially, the education system of Connecticut is strong and doing well. How's it doing in Bobby Jindal's Louisiana? And what's he done with the budget for education in the state?
Well, when it comes to higher education, he's cut it more than I think any other state but Arizona. When I teach at LSU, and when I came to the LSU faculty 9 years ago, LSU was receiving 75% of its budget from direct state appropriations. Today, that number is 13%. And a lot of it has been made up by very steep tuition increases. It's a lot more expensive to go to college in Louisiana than it was. But there have also been a lot of budget cuts in higher education. We've lost a lot of good faculty members. One of your earlier guests talked about the impact of Scott Walker and his sort of attacks on higher education. Here it's been more just the defunding and the demoralization of higher education. We've had a lot of faculty members who've been laid off, who have left and taken their grant money elsewhere as well. But we're in the midst of a governor's election, and I think there's some hope that whoever is elected governor to replace Jindal will put an emphasis on higher education that Jindal did not.
Of course, K-12 education, a big issue in that state as well. And under Bobby Jindal, the Common Core state standards are something originally that he was in favor of, but then as the tide turned in the Republican Party, it's something that he flipped around on.
Yeah, he really did. He was he was not only in favor of it, he was one of the leaders of it. He was running around the state and the country portraying himself, rightly, I think, as one of its creators and its biggest champions. And then when he detected that that public opinion in places like Iowa and South Carolina and other places among Republican primary and caucus goers was changing on this issue, his position changed to the point now that he's probably one of the strongest and most outspoken opponents of Common Core. And I think people here in Louisiana understand that it has really nothing, little or nothing to do with Louisiana politics. It's all about positioning himself to run for president.
Well, and in just the last couple of minutes we have, one of the reasons we put together this panel of reporters from different parts of the country and wanted to talk about this, Robert, is that in many ways the political ambitions of these people really have in many ways driven the policies that they've undertaken. It seems to be just as clear in Louisiana as any place else. Scott Walker's Wisconsin, Chris Christie's New Jersey, they all seem to be being run by governors because they want to make a national profile themselves among the Republican base. And in some ways, I'm sure it's benefited some people in Louisiana. In some ways, I'm sure it's hurt some people in Louisiana as well.
Yeah, you know, Jindal has probably, I would say more than any of the other governors you've talked about, suffered politically in Louisiana because of his national ambitions. His, depending on which poll you consult, his popularity, his job approval rating, I should say, is in the high 20s or low 30s. It's really collapsed here, and a lot of it is because people recognize that he's moved on. He's spent 45% of every day, 45% of all the days of last year outside of Louisiana, and so far this year, I think he's been gone about 75 or 80 days. People in Louisiana understand that this state is really not on the top of his list of priorities.
Robert Mann is an author, a journalist, and a political historian. He writes a weekly political column for NOLA.com. Thank you so much, Robert. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Hey, Keith Vandiven, just the last couple minutes that we have left, I want to put that question that I asked Robert to you here. Obviously, Dan Malloy said over and over again, I'm not running for president. He's not going to run for president against Hillary Clinton in the field in 2016. Maybe he has national ambitions down the road. But his decision to take up the leadership of the Democratic Governors Association has in many ways influenced the way that he talks around national politics, how he's decided to get up next to Chris Christie or Bobby Jindal at various times. How much do you think that his national political ambitions have influenced some of what he's done here as governor?
I think they have influenced them some. I think it's a more situation, though, of how the economy, I almost want to say the economic straitjacket he inherited has affected his ability to be a national voice, some would say a national attack dog for the Democratic Party. Because the economy, especially in the Northeast, hasn't rebounded, which is – it's very ironic. This is something Governors Malloy and Christie share, have very much in common. There are limits to what they can do with their respective agendas, and so – sometimes it's easier to just go out on the national level and message them than if you try to make that case locally. It's very easy to pick them apart. And that's the one thing I think they all have in common is they're so limited, particularly by this sluggish recovery.
Of course, one of the things that he's trying to take on, though, in his big transportation plan is maybe trying to be a national voice for fixing one of the biggest issues in the Northeast, not just in his state, but all over the Northeast. Transportation is one of the big ones.
Right. The unfortunate problem is it's very possible that 2 years from now there may be very little money left in his transportation initiative. And as far as what the governor did in his first term, he likes to talk about transportation funding. I did sarcastic air quotes around funding. He can't say spending because, unfortunately, so much of the financing he approved actually never got borrowed and spent.
Keith Vanniff covers the budget for the Connecticut Mirror. He's our budget guru. Keith, as always, thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Our program today was produced by Josh Nalea. The executive producer of Where We Live is Katie Tolarski. Thanks to Allison Ehrenreich. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.